We have a short issue today because of Rabbi Wasserman, but one final aura on the Noahide laws, then we'll have to eventually move on. And that is, we talk about Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach, that there are seven, but the Gemara in Sanhedrin says that Adam HaRishon only had six out of the seven. Adam HaRishon did not have all seven. So which one did Adam HaRishon not have? The answer is, Adam HaRishon did not have the Isser of Eiver Min HaChai, because Adam HaRishon was not allowed to eat meat at all. So actually, he did have seven. But for him, it was a commandment not to eat anything except vegetables and fruit, and one tree that he wasn't supposed to eat from. And therefore, only after the Mabul, HaKadosh Baruch Hu permitted meat for human consumption, and then Eiver Min HaChai became that extra mitzvah that Adam HaRishon did not have per se, right? So really, he had seven, but he didn't have Eiver Min HaChai. It was subsumed against the general prohibition of eating meat. I'm not going to discuss it b'arichas at this point. That is why there is this argument whether vegetarianism is considered to be the ideal, because that was the madrega of Adam HaRishon kaidem achet, and achilas basor was a concession to the weaker human condition after the Mabul, and therefore one should strive to be a vegetarian. Some have made that argument, at least when there's no mitzvah to eat meat, like Shabbos and Yom Tov. But Rav Kook, I just want to say that Rav Kook, who is often touted as saying that vegetarianism is the ideal state, and when Mashiach comes, we'll go back to vegetarian. Rav Kook himself was not a vegetarian. One needs to know this because it's sometimes erroneously so quoted. Now, he didn't eat steak every night. Nobody ate steak every night, but he was not a vegetarian. And Rav Kook also writes a very, very interesting thing. The idea of moral development. Rav Kook says that reverence for animals and compassion for animals is a very higher level of spiritual sensitivity. But if you try to jump to that super level of being so compassionate of animal welfare that you don't want to slaughter an animal, you can reach that madrega only if you have perfected your human relationships. So it's like the second story. You build a foundation and a first story, and then you go on. And he says, when you try to spiritually skip to a higher level before you've achieved the intermediate levels, the higher level itself becomes destructive. So he says, man can progress to vegetarianism only after they have cured the ills that plague human relationships, including sinas chinam and all of those other things. That's why, for example, Hitler was a vegetarian. Now, one would hardly associate Hitler with reverence for life or respect for human beings or the like. And one doesn't want to prove things with anecdotes, but there's a very, very famous bioethicist who's a professor at Princeton University, Peter Singer. Happens to be Jewish. Peter Singer is the inventor, the founder of the animal welfare movement. PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. In fact, he wrote a book. His most famous book is called Animal Liberation. And he basically adopts the theory that animals are the same as people, and it is a form of racism. He calls it speciesism. Speciesism. It is speciesism to think that your species is any better than an animal species. And why should that species be sacrificed to make our species happy? Right? There's racism, that's no good, etc., right? Speciesism. Now, on one level, that sounds, well, Baruch Hashem, that's, compassionate, humanitarian, caring. On the other hand, in other of his writings, he basically said, and you see how this can lead to very opposite conclusions, he said that since a two-year-old chimpanzee is just as smart, or whatever, is a one-year-old, six-month-old chimpanzee is just as smart as a six-month-old baby. So if two of them are drowning, whatever it would be, there's no reason to save the human being over the animal. And this applied to mentally defective people, etc. Which means, what happens is, when you want to treat animals like people, you wind up treating people like animals. It's kind of a reversal of the ethical judgment. So, Rav Kook's point is very profound, that there has to be a natural progression in the growth of a person's morality. And when he artificially grabs on to a higher cause, when he has not worked on the lower things that need to be done first, then it can lead him under very, very destructive paths. So Rav Kook says, yes, vegetarianism is a messianic aspiration, but it is an aspiration that is achieved after we live in peace, after we live in harmony, when we have Avas Yisrael, when we're at one with the human beings, etc. And until then, we do have laws, not causing pain to animals. That is a halacha right now. But shechita, as I indicated, is very, very painless. And one cannot torture animals, certainly. The halacha is you have to feed animals before you eat yourself. Right? Those are halachas, absolute halachas. But to advocate saying meat is immoral, that is a moral level that we are not yet ready for, and one cannot jump the gun. So when you see in Jewish vegetarian literature that Rav Kook is always cited as a great proponent of vegetarianism, you need to take it in overall context. Everything about Rav Kook is more complicated than people think, and this is also an example of that. Yeah.
Was he a vegetarian through the week, but then on Shabbos he ate meat, or he wasn't a vegetarian at all?
Well, you know, it's hard to know. I mean, people were so poor that everybody was a vegetarian during the week, and mainly on Shabbos too. So I don't think he was a vegetarian as a matter of principle even during the week, but he ate very little meat during the week and not much more on Shabbos either. Okay. So that's one thing. Okay, but again, maybe question and answers, we could elaborate on this more. Okay. So we have the seven Noahide laws. But I want to mention that if you look in the Rambam, there's actually three other laws that Goyim have to keep. And the question is, why aren't they counted in the seven? There ought to be 10 Noahide laws. But there are three more that we add to the list. Law number one, a non-Jew is not allowed to keep the Shabbos. It says explicitly, Goy, or Akum, Sheshavas, a non-Jew that keeps the Shabbos, Chayav Misa, is deserving of death for keeping the Shabbos. A Shabbos was Hashem's gift to the Jewish people, and a non-Jew is not supposed to keep Shabbos. Ad kidei kach, that even if you're converting, if you're a guy who is converting to Judaism, and you obviously have to learn how to keep Shabbos properly, you will be instructed at least one time on Shabbos, do something wrong. Do a malacha. Turn on one light. So you could keep Shabbos 99.9%, but you must be sure to violate Shabbos a little bit, so you shouldn't be a goy that keeps Shabbos, right? Even a convert, a ger, I mean, until the gerus, has to actually violate Shabbos in terms of the malacha. Of course, you know the old joke about the very, very frum candidate for Giyur, who was learning in yeshiva and was a tremendous masmid and tzaddik and frum, and he was not yet Jewish. So some people were annoyed, they thought he was acting too conceited. You know, who do you think you are? So somebody went over to him and said, you think you're so frum? He says, well, I want you to know, every time I see how you keep Shabbos 100%, and you think you're so righteous, but every single Shabbos you're keeping 100%, you're committing a sin, because a non-Jew cannot keep Shabbos. So the guy looks up at the guy and says, oh no, I carry in your Erev every Shabbos. So, okay, you get that? Okay. The basic idea was, he was so frum that for him, carrying in the Erev was desecrating Shabbos. Therefore he said, I do desecrate Shabbos, I carry in your Erev. But okay, yeah.
Which Noahide laws is that?
Okay, so that's the question. So the question is, hey, is that one of the seven? Is that one of the seven? It's not one of the seven. So some commentaries say that we do include it as a form of theft. Since Shabbos was given to the Jewish people, the non-Jew who takes Shabbos is stealing what belongs to Am Yisrael. So you subsume it, you include it as a subcategory of theft. Yeah.
How would they to know that? Like, I'm sure a lot of people here didn't know that. And the sects of Christianity that do that and
pay so. Well, Christianity, of course, actually, it's lucky for them that they keep Shabbos the wrong day. So first of all, understand what I'm saying. When I say it's forbidden for a non-Jew to keep Shabbos, we're talking about they're keeping the 39 malachos. Now, even a Seventh-day Adventist that does indeed observe Saturday as their Sabbath, they certainly don't keep all of these malachos. They'll answer the phone, whatever it is, they'll drive. So it's very, very rare that you would have a non-Jew actually keep the Shabbos according to the halacha. Yeah.
What if a boy accidentally keeps Shabbos,
say he sleeps
all day?
Yeah, that's a very good point. Many commentaries actually say it is only if he intends to keep Shabbos as a religious observance, not if he got drunk and was just unconscious for 24 hours.
Like, yeah. That's giving a power of thought to Goyim that I thought we don't attribute so much to them.
Well, certain things do depend on motive. You know, certain things. The Rambam himself, when he describes the Yisr of a Goy keeping Shabbos, he says, when the Goy wants to serve Hashem by keeping the Shabbos, that's an improper theft. If a Goy just takes off for vacation or sleeps or gets drunk, that would not be doing Shabbos. It wouldn't be doing Shabbos for a Jew, and it's not called doing Shabbos for a Goy. That way, yeah.
I heard a story where this halacha and the Goy said to the rabbi, I told him this, that is it really breaking Shabbos if I'm doing it with the intention, I'm only doing it to break Shabbos? That's my way of keeping Shabbos.
Well, okay. Well, that is what we tell candidates for conversion, that you should intentionally violate Shabbos. Now, let me just mention a famous kasha that the Mefarshim ask on Avraham Avinu, really on all of the others. We have a tradition from the Chazal, the Gemara says in Kedushin, that even though the Torah was not given yet, Avraham Avinu kept all of the Torah before it was commanded. He put on tefillin. He didn't wear shatnez. He kept kosher. He didn't mix meat and milk. That's why even in this week's Parsha it says he first gave them butter or cream and then gave them meat. Because if you have the milk first, you don't have to wait 6 hours. Avraham Avinu kept everything. Because how did he know? How did he know the Torah? Ruach HaKodesh, prophecy. He just knew. The Avos knew the Torah before it was given. But Frecht, the Chassam Sofer and the Hafla, how could Avraham Avinu keep Shabbos? Because really, before the Torah was given, we are really B'nai Noach. So if Avraham wants to go beyond the Halach and do more things, that's fine. But a thing that a Ben Noach is not allowed to do, how could Avraham Avinu voluntarily do it? So how could Avraham Avinu keep Shabbos, since a Noachide who keeps Shabbos is Chayav Misa? So how could he keep kosher? That's fine. Because if a Noachide wants to keep kosher, they're allowed to, so Avraham could be Machmer and keep kosher. But he couldn't be Machmer and keep Shabbos, because Kaidem Matan Torah, we are Noachides. Noachides cannot keep Shabbos. So there are a lot of answers to this question. Let me give you a few answers that the Mefarshim give to this question. One answer that's given is an amazing thing. He did something that for a Goy is Chilul Shabbos, and for a Jew is not Chilul Shabbos. And that is, he went out publicly into the Rosh Hashanah Rabbim wearing tzitzis. Now, here's the thing. A garment that you wear is not called carrying, right? That's why I don't have to go naked when there's no air. Clothing that I wear is called malbush. Malbush is not carrying. But a superfluous garment, something that I didn't need to wear, that might be considered carrying. So for a guy who wears tzitzis, tzitzis is considered to be carrying on Shabbos. But for a Jew, it's not carrying, because there's a mitzvah of tzitzis. So Avraham Avinu, as a Goy, violated Shabbos because tzitzis is carrying. But as a Jew, he didn't violate Shabbos because tzitzis is a garment. And therefore, he was able to do two contradictory things at once. he kept the Shabbos of a Jew, and he violated the Shabbos of a Goy, and therefore he both kept the Noahide law, and he kept the Jewish law at the same time. Right, this is one teretz that is given. Another teretz that is given actually has some major repercussions. We don't paskin like this teretz. But the Hafla was the Rebbe of the Chassam Sefer, says a very big chiddush. We know that the Jewish calendar, the day begins from the night. Shabbos begins at night. But the Hafla says, for non-Jews, the definition of a day is day-night, instead of night-day. It says non-Jews, halachically, have a different definition of day and night. So the definition of Shabbos for a non-Jew, Saturday morning, Saturday night. So Avraham Avinu kept the Jewish Shabbos of Friday night and Shabbos, but by doing Malacha Saturday night, he violated the non-Jewish definition of Shabbos, and therefore he kept Friday night Shabbos, he did Malacha Motzei Shabbos. The definition of Shabbos for a non-Jew is Saturday day, Saturday night. But the point is that we clearly do not paskin that way, because if that would be the case, we would have no reason to tell a candidate for conversion to turn on a light. We would just tell him after Shabbos turn on a light, right? So we don't paskin like this teretz, but this is a teretz that is given.
Why not tell the gear to put on tzitzis then?
You're right. Apparently we don't pass in that teretz either. That's right. You're right. Neither teretz corresponds with our practice. You're right. Now there's a third answer though, which I think is a very good answer actually. And that is, if, as I told you, the prohibition of a non-Jew keeping Shabbos is because you're stealing from the Jew, that can only apply after the Torah was given and Shabbos was given to the Jewish people. Until Shabbos was given to the Jewish people, it didn't belong. There were no Jewish people, first of all. I mean, Avraham is the founder of that. Right? So if the Isser is Gezela, then Kaida Matan Torah, technically the oasis of Mara, because we actually got Shabbos a little earlier than Matan Torah. There can't be Gezela until you own something. Once you own it, it's a gazela for me to take it. Until you own it, it's not gazela. So one could say very pashut that kaidem matan Torah, there would be no prohibition. Only after matan Torah can a non-Jew not keep Shabbos. Now that, I think we might paskin like, because that would explain our present practice, that manazah, the guy has to violate Shabbos. So that is we'll call that supplementary prohibition number one. A guy is not allowed to keep the Shabbos at 100% level. Supplementary prohibition number two, this will also be a hard one. According to the Gemara, a non-Jew is not allowed to learn Torah, because it says Torah Siva Lanu Moshe. Right, God commanded us the Torah, Morasha, to be our legacy. So there actually is a law that says, a halacha, that says a non-Jew is not supposed to learn Torah, and there's a corresponding law that I'm not supposed to teach a non-Jew Torah. In other words, these are actually two different halachas. He can't learn, I'm not supposed to teach him. Now, this raises a million different questions. A million different questions. One question is, so how on earth can a non-Jew learn about Judaism in order to convert if he's not allowed to be taught, he's not allowed to learn? So how is he supposed to become a ger? Number two, how does this apply to mixed groups? I'm giving a shir, or sameach, happens all the time. People walk in. Do I have to monitor? Do I have to kind of determine who's Jewish, who's not Jewish, etc.? A mixed group, in other words, a group which has Jews and possible non-Jews. Number three, how does this apply when you have a website or an internet, or you write a book, or you write articles, or you have a listserv, and there's radio, whatever it is, YouTube, whatever it would be, and non-Jews are listening in? or you're a professor. I'll give you an example. When I was when I used to, in my prior life, I had occasion to actually give a law school class on halachic aspects of reproductive technologies, like surrogate mother. You know what is comparing halacha and American law? Well, 2/3 of the students might be Jewish because they're more interested, maybe, but 1/3 are not Jewish because they want to, you know, either they're interested or they want to just, you know, just get, they take a course. Well, am I allowed? Am I allowed to talk about Gemaras and Torah, you know, to non-Jews? How does all of this apply? So first of all, you need to know the following, a few basic points. It is absolutely clear, although this won't help you that much, it's absolutely clear that anything connected with the seven commandments of Noach, non-Jews certainly not only may learn, but should learn and must learn. That is their Torah, and they are obligated to know that. Now, if you think about it, though, the seven laws of Noach are much bigger than you think. So, for example, if it's forbidden to steal, that permits me to go over all of the halachas of misrepresentation, of fraud. In other words, there are really very large areas of halacha that are connected to the Noachide laws. Don't steal is not just a two-word, you know, law. It has many, many laws about paying wages on time and the like. So, number one, the seven Noachide laws is permitted. Now, to add on to that, therefore, many say, since the very first Noahide law is to believe in God and not to practice idolatry and paganism, then the stories of the Torah, the stories of Adam and Chava and the Avos, and even the stories of, you know, there's the narratives, Yetzias Mitzrayim, these are things that show us how Hashem is involved in the history of the world. Really, Tanakh, the Bible generally, is something that you can teach non-Jews because it enhances our faith in our Kadosh Baruch Hu, and it teaches us ethics and morals, and that's part of the Noahide code. So what is it that you're supposed to avoid with a non-Jew? So the commentaries say it is primarily the detailed discussions of the oral law, meaning you can actually tell them halacha. If a non-Jew asks me, right, they see me sitting in a sukkah. Again, maybe there are fewer non-Jews that are interested in Israel. I don't get too many Arabs that ask me about sukkah and the like. They probably know anyway. But in America, you know, where we live in mixed neighborhoods, so non-Jews are going to ask me, why are you taking a lulav? Or not a lulav, why are you taking that branch? What does that branch represent? What are those black boxes, right? You're on an airplane. And assuming you don't get tackled or arrested because you put on tefillin, which might happen today, what are those boxes on your head, or whatever it is? Now, you don't have to say, sorry, I can't tell you. Or what's the saying? If I tell you, I have to kill you. You know, all of those, then for sure you'll get arrested. The short answer is, you are allowed to briefly explain to anyone who asks what a mitzvah is and why you do it. And that is an element of sanctifying God's name. And that's an element of teaching godliness in the world. And that is not the prohibition of teaching a non-Jew Torah. So the seven mitzvahs are okay. The stories of the Tanakh are okay. Basic explanations of the philosophy and halachas of Judaism are fine. But what you don't do is, you don't sit down with a non-Jew and say, let's learn the Tosfos here on Cheskes Abatim about the Chazakah of 3 years, and let's go over the Ketzos and the Ramban and the Rambam. You don't expose at that point in their lives to the depth and the complexities of the Torah Shebal Peh. So even when you prepare somebody for conversion, it is more nachon to focus anyway on basic halacha, basic philosophy, basic stories, and that you are permitted. Even to someone who's not a candidate for conversion, and Kal V'chomer somebody that is a candidate for conversion, but the depths of the oral law should be reserved to after a person is already converted. Now, that does raise the question of mixed groups. So if I'm giving a Gemara share, and there are people who have not yet converted, am I allowed to give my share? So that's another machlokas. Some say if your predominant audience is Jews, you don't have to be concerned for the occasional person. In other words, that's a separate cheshbon. In other words, until you get to the detailed oral law, I could even teach the guy one-on-one. But I could not teach the guy one-on-one Gemara. But in a mixed group, you know, there where we're fairly lenient, because you can basically say, my kavanah is to teach the Jews. If a non-Jew listens, that's not my particular achrayus, right? So be, at least be aware of these parameters. Yeah.
If there's somebody who comes to the shir normally, we know it's not Jewish, he raised a hand and asked a question.
Yeah.
Is that a new concern? Is it like one-on-one?
It is a good question, but given the fact that you're addressing your answer to the group, so I think even if it's in response to the individual person's question, I think you can say I'm teaching the group. I'm explaining something to my group of Jewish students. So I would think that we would be fairly lenient with respect to that. Yeah.
When you speak about like Olam Haba and things, could it apply
to yes, that? Yes. So this is an interesting point. Things about Mashiach, things about Olam Haba, are actually appropriate to talk to non-Jews about, because they establish belief in God and in the concept of reward and punishment. And that is an important aspect of Noahide theology as well, because a non-Jew should believe in God, must believe in God, and should understand the idea of reward and punishment and the purpose of the world. So interestingly enough, I don't want to say halacha psuka, but a sefer like Derech Hashem, which talks about how God runs the world. Now that's a complex work, it's not a simple work, but it could very well be, I don't want to say halacha lemaisa, that is something you can study with a non-Jew, because it's teaching them about God. It's not teaching them the details of the halachic system that belongs to Jews, it's teaching them general ideas of how God runs the world. So even if it's complicated, but when it's dealing with Hashem, as opposed to the details of the halacha, that you would be allowed to teach, yeah.
If we were to teach like Tanakh, which is written, which is okay, so I mean we can really only understand Tanakh based on like Shab by rabbis.
Yeah. So by listen. By definition, when you teach Tanakh, you will be bringing in ideas from Gemara and Medrash, but you try to keep it on a more basic, simple level, just what we call pshat, without getting into the more complex ideas. Yeah.
Is that what the rabbi did this year?
I relied on something else. I actually relied on I relied, number one, on the mixed group that I was really talking to the Jews. Number two, there was a tshuva of the Sri Deyesh, Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, who had a different heter. His heter is, you can almost call it a Mack truck heter. He really said, it's a very, very big heter. He said that if something is being studied for intellectual stimulation and not for religion, such as you're an academic and you're doing comparative cultural studies, he said it's not usher at all. It's only usher. Now, he compared it to Shabbos. The same way, see, he's drawing an analogy, the same way the prohibition of the non-Jew keeping Shabbos is only when it's done for religious worship. He says, that's a big chiddush, the isser of the guy studying Torah is only when it's done for religious worship and not when it's done out of purely intellectual curiosity. So I can tell you in the university setting it is never done for religious reasons. It's always done just either for intellectual enjoyment or just to get credit, really. Probably wasn't even done for intellectual enjoyment, just want to get credit in a course. Now that's a very big catcher, and not everybody would agree, but this is what the Sri Deyesh says. The reason is, you know, the Sri Deyesh himself, I don't know if you know much about him, maybe one time I'll talk more about him. He was a Talmud of the Altar of Slobodka, so he was an older chaver of Aaron Cutler, all the great people who became Gedolim of the next generation. But he also had a PhD from universities in Germany, and he spent much of his life in Germany, and he did lecture in universities as well as having a yeshiva. So in effect he was writing a tshuva defending what he himself was actually doing. And these are the heterim that he developed. Okay, all right. So I mentioned two supplementary Noahide laws, right? One is the supplementary law of not keeping Shabbos, and the other is the supplementary law of not learning Torah. There's a third law, which is also a pretty hard one for people, and that is, you know, the Torah prohibits castration, right? We know this. But the Torah prohibits not only human castration, the Torah prohibits animal castration. animal castration, meaning you're not allowed to castrate a dog or a cat. Now, this is, if you're a Jew, for sure, that's one of the 613 mitzvos, destruction of reproductive organs. Now, if, God forbid, a human being has, let's say, testicular cancer, God forbid, or a woman has ovarian cancer, then certainly, for pikuach nefesh, you can remove whatever has to be removed. We're not talking about that. It's an animal, it's an interesting question, because pikuach nefesh doesn't really apply to animals. So the question is, are you allowed to spare the animal? Okay, those are shilas. But certainly in the absence of something like a life-threatening condition, castration is absolutely prohibited. So even when contraception is allowed, whatever it is, a woman cannot tie her tubes, which is called tubal ligation, and a man cannot have a vasectomy. That's considered to be a form of castration or anatomical sterilization. Okay, that is not a permissible mode of contraception, even if contraception in theory might be permitted. Now, before I get to the Noahide law, let me just talk about the dilemma this causes for pet owners. You know, you're a pet owner, right? You love animals. Okay? So you have a cat, you have a dog. Well, the first thing that every humane society will tell you, if they haven't done it, is you get your animal spayed. So there shouldn't be all of these, like we have here, all of these wild cats that are running around. Although I have to say, you know, I don't know, I think maybe it's because you guys are nicer to the cats or something. They've become a lot more civilized than they used to be. So, in the olden days, I remember they were like vicious cats, like constantly, like, you know, marauders. Now they're kind of, you know, they're kind of living off the fat of the land. I don't know. Okay. So, I don't know if that's good or bad, but I do see a difference in the temperament of the cats here. So they're much nicer than they used to be. But anyway, so there's a really big problem. How can I get my cat spayed? Or to put it from the doctor's perspective, and I know some people like this, if you're a veterinarian, and you're a Jewish veterinarian who's from, now, veterinarians make their parnasa primarily, 90% of their parnasa, if you're a small animal vet, is spaying dogs and cats. That's how you make your living. Now you're telling me you're not allowed to do that. So how can a religious Jew be a veterinarian? So they work out different heterim. The heterim are very shvach heterim, but the poskim allow them. Say again?
The religious goy as well.
Yeah, well, I'll get to the Noah. I didn't get to the Noahid law yet, but it doesn't work for a Jew. And, okay, so before I give you that answer, let me just mention that according to the Rambam, the castration laws apply to non-Jews as well as Jews, and therefore, B'nai Noah are also not allowed to engage in castration of animals. Now, what is that under? That's hard to figure out. I can understand how Shabbos and learning could be subsumed under theft, because God gave the Shabbos to the Jewish people, God gave the Torah to the Jewish people. What Noahide law does castration fit under? In other words, it doesn't seem to fit under, unless you're going to call it murder, it's a type of murder, destroying the reproductive capacity. Maybe, but it doesn't fit. But there's a real problem here with the veterinarian now, because here is the problem. The heter that poskim give to a Jewish veterinarian is have your non-Jewish assistant do the final cut. Meaning, dog is brought in, right? The dog is going to be spayed. So I'm the Jewish doctor, right? So I can set up the prep and I can set up the operation and I can do all these things. And the final scissors, right? Take scissors and snip it. So I don't do that. I give it to my non-Jewish assistant, and they do it. And in that way, I, the veterinarian, has not transgressed the prohibition of castration. This is the commonly advised practice for the relatively few religious Orthodox veterinarians that there are. Now the problem is, how does that work at all? If you follow the Rambam, that the prohibition of castration is one of the Noahide laws, then I'm not allowed to cause a non-Jew to violate the Noahide law. In fact, I transgress the law of Lifnei Iver Lo Sitei Mishra. And you're not allowed to put a stumbling block in front of a blind person. The Gemara says, Beferish, the same way you cannot cause a Jew to transgress one of the 613, you are not allowed to cause a non-Jew to transgress the Noahide laws. I can't give an Eiver Menachai to a non-Jew. So the question is, this seems, the Rambam's Psach seems to undermine legamri, totally, the heter that we give to the Jewish veterinarian. We tell the Jewish veterinarian, you don't do the castration, give it to your non-Jewish assistant. If I tell my non-Jewish assistant to castrate, I am telling my non-Jewish assistant to transgress, it's not one of the seven laws, but one of the Noahide laws. It's not one of the seven, but it's a supplementary Noahide law. So, that's Lifnei Iver Lo Sitei Mishra. It's a very, very big kasha. Obviously, this psak is disagreeing with the Rambam and seems to maintain that the castration law only applies to a Jew and not to a non-Jew, and therefore you can get the goy to do it. But like the Rambam, it seems to me there is no way you can be a Jewish veterinarian. In fact, there's no way you can be a non-Jewish veterinarian. I mean, the non-Jewish veterinarian is transgressing, and as a Jew, you wouldn't be allowed to get the non-Jew to do it. Now, I will say this. It is important to know that the prohibition against animal castration is only anatomical castration. That means physically severing, cutting. There are forms which are still experimental, but technology is changing, which are actually chemical castration, meaning taking injections or pills that cause a shriveling of the blood supply to that area and the organs atrophy of their own accord. Interestingly enough, chemical sterilization of that nature that does not involve physical anatomical cutting is not prohibited under this law. And if that ever gets developed, because some people are developing, because animals also have a recovery period, so to speak, so this would make their faster recovery. So when chemical sterilization methods get more prevalent, this would allow more religious Jews to be veterinarians and to engage in this practice. Yeah?
How do we know that it's just anatomical castration that's
There are proofs from the Gemara itself. The Gemara itself says that taking drugs that cause sterilization are not prohibited, except for pruervu, except for, you know, in other words, for a human being to take it would be a violation of the mitzvah of having children, but it would not be a violation of the castration laws. Okay, so that would be something to think about. Yeah?
Could a Jewish person or a pet owner bring their dog to a non-Jewish veterinarian?
Okay, so theoretically, well, like the Rambam, no, but if you follow the rule that the non-Jew doesn't have the Aveira, it would appear to be the case that that would be all right, that would be okay. But I will tell you that the minhag is, like chametz, that if I want to get my dog spayed, I actually sell my dog to my non-Jewish friend or neighbor, and they bring it in. So, whether that's that may be a superfluous step. It may be the case, but the minhag is that the Jewish the animal should not be owned by a Jew, even when it is sterilized or spayed. Yeah.
We've always had dogs. Would it be okay if I didn't mention this law to my parents?
Well, if your dogs are already spayed, in fact, the simple answer is when you buy a dog, buy an already spayed dog. You know, then you don't have a. You know, you don't have a problem. Why, are the dogs not spayed yet, or are you getting new dogs?
When one dies, you like get a new one. And
yeah. Well, again, there is a general rule in Judaism that if people are not going to listen to you, it is usually better not to bring things up. The way Chazal describe it, better that they violate the Torah accidentally or inadvertently than they violate the Torah on purpose, intentionally. So if you would judge that it would not be effective, so it's better not to.
Even if it's like 50-50 whether they would listen?
Well, if there's a 50-50 chance, maybe bring it up. I mean, I told you that the custom basically is, here's what the custom is. The custom is that you kind of transfer for a day the dog to your non-Jewish neighbor, and they bring it to a non-Jewish veterinarian, and even though it's problematical like the Rambam, but the minhag is that we allow the sterilization to take place that way. So it's just an extra ceremony that you would undergo. Okay? So these are the three supplementary Noahide laws. Don't keep Shabbos, don't learn Torah, and the prohibition against the animal castration. Okay? All right, we'll stop here and see you tomorrow.